This evening, we're going to be, the last lesson is on worship. There are two examples that we have given in the scripture passages for this lesson concerning worship. One is from Isaiah chapter 6, which is the call of Isaiah, and the other is from Revelation 4, which deals with not just worship in general, but specifically worship talks about, actually a lot of the background for Revelation chapter 4 is found in Ezekiel, especially in particular Ezekiel chapter 1. But we will be thinking about worship and what constitutes worship and what is the purpose of worship. If we were to look at all of this and talk about worship, if we were to put ourselves in Isaiah's place, and sometimes over the years in Old Testament in particular, sometimes I would portray this part of Isaiah's call as well as the his first sermon recorded in chapter 1 as a character, and I would, of course y'all know I'm a character, but as a character, and I would exit the room, tell him I'll be back in a few minutes, change into garb, and then pop in the door. In the year the king Uzziah died, I saw the Lord high and lifted up, and his train filled the whole temple, and the thresholds of the temple shook at the sound of his voice. And the seraphs were flying back and forth, each having six wings. With two he covered his face, with two he covered his nakedness, and with two he flew. And they cried one to another, Kadosh, 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 Yahweh, Sabaoth, which is holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. And I told, when I'd finished, I said, now you can go home and tell all of your family members that your professor spoke in a strange language, a strange tongue today. Although it was Hebrew, but for them it was strange. But that call for Isaiah is such a moving thing for him because of worship. Isaiah is actually in the temple serving when he has this vision. It is in the year that King Uzziah died. Uzziah had been had become king at age 16. He ruled for 52 years. He had done some good things. In fact, in 2 Kings, we're told that he did what was right in the sight of the Lord, but then turns right around and says, however, he didn't remove the rival worship sites, and so God struck him with leprosy because he didn't do that. So it's in this, but it's in this year that Uzziah died that Isaiah has this call. Now, Isaiah was actually kin to the royal family. Isaiah was a priest. In fact, some of his message in chapter 1, where he kind of slams the priests and the religious leadership, he's talking to himself as well. Some things that he had been responsible for at an earlier time. And so here we come to this. And I would ask you the question, have you ever had a time where you could fill in the following blank? In the year blank, I saw God in an extra wonderful way. Not necessarily a vision like Isaiah had, but think for a moment. Is there a time in your life where you experience God in an extra wonderful way and you can remember clearly that movement of God, whether it was God calling you to do something or God revealing something to you in the way that worship took place? If so, think about where you were, what it was like to find yourself in that kind of presence of God, where that movement took place that was something out of the ordinary for you. Did it help you to see yourself in a different way? I mean, Isaiah is here in the early part of the book, and at his call, Isaiah is a court priest. He is used to what he has been doing, and all of a sudden, he has this vision, this wondrous vision of God, which suddenly puts his life in a different perspective, as well as his call in a different perspective. Did this change your life? Or how did it change your life? for a few of you, the wheels are turning, and I can see that there's a light going on. And for others, no. Yes. Well, and I think that you know, many people have different kinds of, and in different ways. Some people have Damascus Road experiences. Some people have much more muted experiences, and experience God in a different way. So you know, no one, and my next line here was, none of us experience God exactly the same way. And that's why, you know, this, think about where you were. Was there some, and what did that do for you, and how may it have changed you? And so, you know, that's, you know, some of us have those Damascus Road experiences, and some it's much more subtle, a much more subtle movement within and around. And that can be in its own way, even those subtle movements. We can get to a point to where we look up and we look back and we think, I mean, it can be just as life-changing and as awe-inspiring as your experience or Paul's on the road to Damascus or anybody else that has that, the big bang or big flash kind of thing. Here with Isaiah, obviously it is it's a vision that he experiences. Those around him don't experience it. But it's something that's peculiar to him in this particular instance. But he is indeed standing, and some of this may be also in part because of where he is and the timing of everything. He is serving in the temple. And so he noticed, though, that he describes everything around, and the only description of God, the only descriptions of God are his robe, his voice, that he is holy, and he is king. There, and that in part too is the Hebrew reticence to try and make any description of God whatsoever, because God's too great for our words to describe. And so here we find Isaiah, and he says, I saw the Lord, and if you will, you know, the word in the Hebrew text here is Yahweh, the Lord sitting on a throne, high and lofty, high and lifted up. That is, he is above all, and he is above every level of heaven and every creature whatsoever. The hem of his robe fills the temple. Seraphs were in attendance above him. Each had six wings. With two they covered their faces, with two they covered their feet. Not really what that word means, but, and with two they flew. And, you know, these seraphs are depicted oftentimes, seraphim are depicted as winged creatures, but not with a human form. very often seraphim are depicted as winged snakes. Another use of seraph would be similar to when Moses holds a snake up on the staff in the wilderness. That becomes the symbol for medicine. But seraphs are creatures that are created by God to do God's bidding and God's service at all times. Just as cherubim are. And cherubim are generally not the little fat, chubby things with wings that float around. Cupid in the trilogy of the Santa Claus 2, and the Santa Claus 3. Cherubs are described in various ways, but typically they also oftentimes have the head of an animal, sometimes lions, etc., because they also represent something of God's power and God's authority, the cherubim in their service to God. So here he is serving, and suddenly he finds himself in the very presence of God, where the whole heavenly host is worshiping God. Is worshiping God. And they're crying. The seraphim are flying back and forth, and they're crying one to another, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts." Now, the interesting thing, Hebrew word kadosh is the same root word from which sometimes you'll find, and we translate that holy, but oftentimes you'll find in the Hebrew text when it says, "And you are to be separate, come out from among them and be separate," or to be different. That's the same root word. Holy, holy, holy. God is other. God is separate from creation. And yet God oversees creation. And Isaiah is allowed to be in the very presence of God here. But this thrice holy gives an understanding that no temple can contain the holy of God, the holiness of God. No temple can contain the holiness of God. In fact, here we're told that the threshold, the pivots on the threshold, or the threshold itself, shook at the voices of those who called, and the house, and here house is the whole temple, the whole earth, filled with smoke. This whole vision is filled with smoke. And by the way, not only did the thresholds shake, but Isaiah shook too, I'm sure. Because he recognizes he's in the very presence of God, which brings this whole awe-inspiring understanding. And God's holiness itself allows for Isaiah to recognize his sinfulness. Anything we... Oh, okay. I get that sometimes, too. They'll call, I'll answer, and then they just sit there. So I go... After the second hello, I go click. Isaiah's reaction here, though, is to recognize not just God's holiness, but the other reaction, his immediate gut reaction is what? To recognize his own. What's he say? "Woe is me, I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips, yet..." He can't believe this. "My eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." So Isaiah's reaction is to recognize that he lived among a people of unclean lips. Now, what does that mean? In the context of worship, and a number of commentators have suggested this, including some rabbis, and I think it's very apropos, in the context of worship here, and he's serving as a priest in worship. And the fact that if you go back to chapter 1, there's so many things in here that relate to worship and worship that is unacceptable to God in chapter 1. He's living among a people, including himself, including those priests who only give lip service to God. The unclean lips here are an indication that they're only giving lip service to God, including himself. The first thing he has to do before he can accept any call or help anyone else in any way, shape, or form, is to recognize his own sinfulness and then present himself before God, which is a part of what we do with worship anyway. We're presenting to God, not for our own good. Anytime people come and they say, "Well, you know, I didn't get anything at all out of the service. Well, the problem wasn't that there wasn't something to get out of the service. The problem was they came expecting for them rather than what they were to offer. And so when he recognizes this and admits it, what happens? What's God's reaction to Isaiah? Oh, y'all know this story. Right. One of the seraphs takes a coal and touches it to his lips. That live coal, fire purifies. That's that whole image there. But God's reaction when Isaiah recognizes his sinfulness in the presence of a holy God and he himself really is unworthy to offer worship to that God because of his sinfulness, God's reaction is to purify and forgive him. Isaiah receives cleansing forgiveness from God. At which point then he can offer himself in service, which is really what worship is about as well. The worship service, a number of years ago, you may or may not recall, one of the message titles was The Service of Worship. And we didn't talk in that time about the worship service. We were talking about our lives as service, as worship to God. Paul says that in Romans 12, 1 and 2. Judas betrayed him in the garden. Peter denied him three times. We do those kinds of things, but it doesn't mean that one cleansing. And this, I think, is where a lot of folks, my opinion, that Nadal gets your drink, the drink machine, where a lot of folks go wrong is they think they get that one forgiveness and that one cleansing. They've been dunked, poured, or sprinkled, and they're set for the rest of life. But here, Isaiah had been offering sacrifices of purification and everything else. And suddenly he realized that he wasn't clean at this point. And so he needed that before he could offer to God the worship that God truly needed. And his reaction, this has touched your lips, your guilt has departed, your sin is blotted out. Now does that mean his sin forever was blotted out? Only those sins for which he was currently being forgiven. So a part of worship involves the recognition of our own sinfulness so that we can then offer ourselves to God in a greater way. We can't really do that as long as we continue with that. You know, Paul later talks about in 1 Corinthians concerning the Lord's Supper. He talks about people not... You know, the people were approaching the Lord's Supper without examining themselves and making things right. And he said, that's part of the reason why some of you have the problems you've got, because you're profaning the very sacrifice. And that was an extremely worshipful time. But note God's invitation then. God's initiative and his invitation. Isaiah gets cleansed. God says, whom shall I send? Who will go for us? Isaiah says, I mean, he's excited. Here I am. God says, okay, you've offered yourself to me. What he's offering is himself as worship. His life as worship. Because worship is more about what we present to God than what we get back. Well, there are many times when we should. But the majority of people, majority of the time, we don't think about those things. Our solidly practicing Roman Catholic friends are much more attuned to that, because no self-respecting, solidly practicing Roman Catholic would go to Mass without having gone to confession. But we don't think about it, and I honestly believe, and I've made this statement a lot of times in the last 35 years or so in different venues, and you'd be surprised the smiles I get or the little nod. There are a lot of folks that don't let the plate pass, don't let the cups pass. They take anyway, even if they've thought about it, because they know that there's somebody sitting behind them that's watching, and if they don't, they're going to be the subject at lunch. But, you know, we do that a lot. But, you know, it should be something, if we choose that, then it should be something that's, you know, that's quiet, etc. Not, you know, Jesus said to the people in the Sermon on the Mount that you shouldn't let people know you're fasting. Don't go around with long faces and sackcloth and ashes, but clean your face and put the oil on so that they're not, because the Pharisees did it for show. Once again, your Father who sees in secret. So God's invitation is here. Okay, then go and teach these people and work with these people, but guess what? They're not going to pay attention. But still offer that as your worship. And Isaiah's response, oh, but wait a minute, how long? When can I quit? And oftentimes we think about that too, right? Well, I had a drug problem when I was young. I was drugged to church every time the doors was open. I was drugged to school, you know. All that kind of stuff. And I've had people say, well, in fact, I can think of a young man in his 50s now that every time I see him, I say, you know, you going back to church? No, because my parents drug me there. Every time the doors were open when I was growing up, I've had enough church to last me all my life. I said, ooh. But, you know, we look to limit God. God said, nope, always. There's no time limit on serving God and worshiping God. There's no time limit on serving God in this life except the end of this life. Right? And so Isaiah here is called. He meets God in this time of worship that is awe-inspiring, that first of all gets him to look at his life and see where he is so that he can be used of God as he offers his life in worship. So that worship then brings us to that point where we should be looking as to how God would have us worship Him and what we offer to God as worship. You know, Paul says, present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable, which is your reasonable service. That's a worship service, the service of worship. You know, a lot of times we think, well, yeah, I'm going to worship service and we're going to have this and this and this. And we do have certain structures. Every denomination has its own structure as to how it relates and does worship, right? I've told y'all before, I had a guy I went to seminary with who lasted no more than 3 months at a particular church that he went to as pastor. His first pastor, and he went and he decided he was going to move the offering from where it was in the middle of the service to, like some of our other more high church friends, to the end of the service after the sermon. Some of my friends who were in some of those denominations, I said, well, I guess you can tell how good a sermon you had by how much shows up in the plate, right? And I said, well, no, we're not going to do that. And he got crossways with the son of the chairman of the board of deacons, and in 3 months he was gone. But, you know, we look at those things and we have to remember that worship is not just about us. It's about, as individuals, about us. Which then brings us to Isaiah had this experience in worship, in this vision. The author of the Apocalypse, whatever John that might have been, in Revelation chapter 4 relates also a similar vision. And a vision which is very similar to Ezekiel as well. The vision of God. enthroned. And as you go on into chapter 5, it's the vision of God and of the Lamb. And so he has a vision of an open, he has a vision of an open door where he can view God's heavenly court. Interestingly enough, Isaiah views the heavenly court and the workings of the heavenly court. Here, in the Apocalypse, John is viewing the heavenly court. After this, I looked, and there in heaven, a door stood open, which is very different from a lot of things that you find in the Hebrew Scriptures where you can't look on God, right? And the first voice which I had heard speaking to me, like a trumpet, said, "Come here, and I will show you what must take place after this." At once I was in the Spirit, and there in heaven stood a throne, with one seated on the throne. This is a grand, majestic throne. Very similar to what we find in Isaiah. Similar vision here. Now, verses, these couple of verses along through here, and the ones that follow, are oftentimes used to try and talk about the rapture of the church. But that's not what's meant here. In fact, rapture is nowhere in the book of Revelation anyway. And the one seated there looks like jasper and carnelian. And around the throne is a rainbow that looks like an emerald. Around the throne are 24 thrones, and seated on the thrones are 24 elders dressed in white robes with golden crowns on their heads. Coming from the throne are flashes of lightning and rumblings and peals of thunder, and in front of the throne burn seven flaming torches, which are the seven spirits of God. And in front of the throne there is something like a sea of glass, like crystal. Around the throne, on each side of the throne, are four living creatures full of eyes in front and behind. The first living creature like a lion, the second living creature like an ox, the third living creature with a face like a human face, and the fourth living creature like a flying eagle. And the four living creatures, each of them with six wings, are full of eyes all around and inside. Day and night without ceasing, they sing, "Holy, holy, holy, the Lord God, the Almighty, who was and is to come." And whenever the living creatures give glory and honor and thanks to the one who is seated on the throne, who lives forever and ever, the 24 elders fall before the one who is seated on the throne and worship the one who lives forever and ever. They cast their crowns before the throne, singing, "You are worthy, our Lord and God, to receive glory and honor and power." By the way, if that sounds familiar, it comes out of the Messiah, in particular, Hallelujah Chorus. "For you created all things, and by your will they existed, and they were created." Here the author has a revelatory experience of God, and then he describes the appearance of God seated on the throne as jasper and carnelian. Jasper, it was very translucent, sometimes had a green hue, but was almost crystal clear. There are some commentators who think that jasper was an early version of what we know as a piece of coal that's been put under pressure for a long time and turned into a diamond. But notice, in neither case are they describing God in physical features, but in other features, because God's too great to describe. Carnelian was a reddish brown, and it was carnelian was also a jewel that was considered connected to royalty. The rainbow is a rainbow of emeralds. It's not the Emerald City, but it's a rainbow of emeralds around the throne here. And everything and everyone is worshiping the one seated on the throne. Around the throne, 24 thrones and 24 elders and white robes and golden crowns, and there's flashes of lightning, thunder, all these kinds of things. All of which are, thunder and lightning are oftentimes associated with God. In particular, can anyone think about thunder and lightning associated with a theophany of God? An important theophany of God in the Hebrew Scriptures. Mount Sinai, the theophany, the appearance of God, was a tremendous thunderstorm that lasted for 40 days and 40 nights. There are other places God wasn't in the earthquake or the lightning. The Transfiguration, there is that kind of experience as well.
Thank you.
inadequately. Well, if they are literally jewels, or he's trying to describe this by the most precious jewels, etc., as my short answer a minute ago was inadequately. Human language is inadequate to fully describe God, and that's what I think we have here. And it's just like later in the Apocalypse where there are discussions, or he talks about the heavenly Jerusalem, streets of gold, not but what he's trying to do, not literally, and all these different carnelian and jasper and emerald and agate and chrysoprase and all these others. He's using the most precious gemstones and metals that they knew to describe the heavenly Jerusalem, or the place where around the throne of God where people would be. And even that is inadequate. If it were written today, we might use diamonds and platinum and things like that. So you know, he is using in this vision, once again, this is... there are some who would contend that he was actually carried into heaven. Most would contend that it was some kind of vision or manifestation that he was shown, like in a dream, in which case you could stand these kinds of things much more. But he's trying then to describe this, and the 24 elders are probably the 12 tribes and the 12 apostles, because in Revelation 21, it talks about the foundations of the city. The heavenly Jerusalem is having the 12 tribes are written on the gates, and the foundation stones have the 12 of the 12 gates, have the names of the 12 apostles, those kinds of things as well. Some have contended that this 24 is actually, there were 24 different orders of priesthood in the Jerusalem temple. And these 24 elders represented the 24 different levels of priesthood. In other words, complete service of worship to God from the lowest of the priests to the highest. Jürgen Roloff thinks that the 24 refers to 24 hours in the day, and the elders represent before God the fullness of time and the purpose of praising God ceaselessly. Ceaselessly. And so here we've got this, once again, this description that is awe-inspiring about who God is. That is, God is the only one who deserves worship. The only one who deserves worship in any instance, in any case whatsoever. And not just our worship. If the elders, if the four living creatures, if the seraphim, if the cherubim, if all of these angels and angelic beings worship God, then we too are to offer, like the elders, 24/7, we are to offer our lives as lives of worship. The seven lights before the throne are similar to a menorah. Even here, because he's got his audience is made up of Jews and Gentiles. Here in the book of Revelation, we have that continued idea that you don't have Judaism, and then Christianity is totally separate, but they are linked together. It's the same God who created in the beginning, who continues to create, and who is over it all. And so there's a blending of these things. By the way, can anybody, just out of curiosity, the four living creatures, lion, ox, a winged creature with a human face, and a great flying eagle. Any idea about the references? At least how some of the church fathers saw them? Actually, Matthew is the winged human because he's the book of generations of Jesus and the strongest of humanity, or strongest of creation. Mark is the winged lion. He begins with a prophetic utterance from the wilderness, much like in the prophets. And the lion is the greatest of the wild animals. The ox, Luke, is the one who talks about the sacrifice in the temple and also in the prodigal son, the calf. And the ox is the strongest of all domestic animals. I don't know. They didn't have draft horses back then. And then John is the eagle, the one who gives the highest description of the divine word and light and life. And the eagle is the greatest of all the birds. So those later in Christian, just kind of as a sidelight, in Christian tradition, Irenaeus, Augustine, all kinds of others, associated these four creatures, which actually you find in Ezekiel chapter 1, associated them with the four gospel writers who brought that good news of God. But notice, they sing this same song, holy, holy, holy. It's a recognition. In fact, in Hebrew, and I know this is poor English, but in Hebrew, the kadosh, 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 the holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts, would be kind of like saying the mostest holiest that there can be. There is nothing more holy. That thrice holy. And the number three in Hebrew numerology is an extremely important number. Remember, we've talked about that before. Anytime something occurs in a series of three, it's like waving a red flag. Saying, hold on, time out. God's doing something here. Well, here again, we've got this thrice holy. Holy, holy, holy. The Lord God, the Almighty, who was and is to come. So you've got the thrice holy, but you've also got past, present, future. Three different time frames, which signifies this holiness of God, the only one who is worthy of worship. And the seraphim, the cherubim, these winged creatures, what do? Day and night without ceasing they sing. In other words, all of their existence is dedicated to worshiping God. And whenever the living creatures give glory and honor and thanks, the 24 elders fall before the one who is seated. They fall down before God's throne. They prostrate themselves, which is an act of submission, not just an act of worship, but an act of submission. And some other world religions take that very literally. Submission. Muslim is one who has submitted to the will of Allah. And it's no accident that they lie down prostrate in front of God when they pray. It's not just a position of worship, it's a position of submission, a recognition of sinfulness and submission to God. That's the case here too within this Christian writing. Submission, submitting self to God who is set apart and separate. For John, the community of faith is a worshiping community. Throughout the book of Revelation, there is worship after worship after worship after worship. Worship is not an option or an addendum for Christians. Worship is an expectation. Worship can be formal. Worship can be informal. But worship of God is an expectation. It's not an addendum to the life. Although a lot of folks say, well, you know, when I'm finished doing everything else, then maybe I'll get around to it. In fact, worship is at the heart of the people of God. A friend of mine and former colleague, Mitchell Reddish, Mitch wrote Smith and Hell's commentary on the book of Revelation. And I'd like to share something of what Mitch says concerning in connecting this to life now, not just then, this particular section. And I quote, "Oftentimes today worship is devalued, especially when the focus of the service is not on God, whether it's the speaking of the word or the prayers or the hymns. Worship is devalued when the focus is not on God. The hymns are themselves an offering from the worshiper to God." A lot of times we don't even, people don't, they sit there and don't do anything. Frequently, modern day worship is treated as entertainment. Music and sermons are chosen on the basis of their appeal to the worshipers rather than on their ability to transport the worshiper to the throne of God or to challenge them to approach God's throne. And I'm including this because this is how I was brought up. He puts this in here. Congregational applause of choral music or solos is inappropriate because it shifts the focus from God to the performer. Because the focus is supposed to be on God and what we offer to God. It shifts the focus from God to the performer. Worship is so important in the book of Revelation because John rightly understood that worship is also a political act. Through worship, one declares one's allegiance and one's loyalty. Through repeated acts of worship, not just personal but corporate, one reconfirms that commitment, and corporate worship is crucial because it is a statement to the world that the church will bow to no other gods but God alone. End of quote. It should. It should. I go back to Romans chapter 12. I appeal to you, therefore, brothers and sisters, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual or reasonable worship. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. Just as I would contend that just as the 24 elders, just as the living creatures, just as the seraphim and the cherubim and all the different angels that might be present, worship, their purpose is to offer worship and praise to God ad infinitum. So more and more of our lives are to be offered as worship. A recognition that we fall short, but also praise and thanksgiving to God that God doesn't cast us aside when we truly come to the point to where we offer what is acceptable to God, and that is self. I'm reminded of the story, and it's a true story. I actually knew the missionary who was present, of a small church in Africa. And when the offering plate was passed, it was a very poor church. There were a lot of folks that dropped in a little bit. And there was one young man who had recently made a profession of faith to God. And when the offering plate came by, he had nothing. He put the offering plate on the floor, and he put one foot inside of it and then the other foot inside with that one, offering himself for God's use as worship. Now, all of this is a whole lot easier said than done. Whole lot easier to say than to do. But one of the habits, one of those 14 habits, and I'm sure there are many others that we could do, but in this study, one of those 14 habits, the climactic one at the end for highly effective disciples, is worship. Corporate worship, private worship, daily worship. Not just in our prayers, but in the things that we do, the things that we say, and the ways that we seek to live our lives with God. And our choir director's probably not surprised that you're not over there yet. About 7.5, but yeah. Okay. I've kept my book. I hope that you will keep your book and every now and then look at it. In marital counseling, I had a third session with a couple that I'm doing a wedding in May. It's a former student worker of Mary's. And I give them all kinds of homework to do as well. And I was telling Anna and Patrick the other day. They said, well, we did our homework. We did this. I said, that's good. I said, now... And we talked about some of the things. They discovered some new things that they didn't know and some things that they thought, oh, we were right on that. I said, now, I'm going to tell you this again the next time we meet, the final session, and the day that you get married. That's great. That's well and good. But do this again after a year, and then again in the fifth year, and again in the tenth year, and just see what's there. And I would recommend that we all consider taking this book and maybe sometime 6 months or a year from now, just personally going through it again, that we might do this. Anyone else before we close for the evening? We won't have these next week. We'll do something else. in preparation for this, but probably the week after we will start, and I'll have them available during the week. Who do you say that I am? 10-week reflections on Jesus. Homework, which I hope will help us to offer and live lives of worship, even though God knows I fall so short so much of the time. So, as you go, may you find rest and restoration during the night. And may you find the peace that God is present and watching even when we're not. God bless you and go in that peace. Amen.